This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, it takes a hop off the path.
You gotta be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You gotta hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that!
Well, I would like to welcome Korn Ferry Tour winner, President's Cup participant, winner of over $11.5 million just on the PGA Tour, Brendan DeYoung, to the Sub 70 Podcast Pro. Thanks for doing this part two. Hopefully, you know, the recording will actually work, and you know, we can get this to actually transpire this time.
No problem. Looking forward to it. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, no worries. Since we talked last, lots of stuff in golf has come up. Let's get into that stuff first. We'll get into your career, which is so interesting, and everything you accomplished and kind of growing up in South Africa. But, you know, as I put in this, you've played on President's Cup, and very similar to the Ryder Cup. You know, I figure we'll dive into that a little bit. You know, I always think it's interesting, you know, for the rookies, what should they expect? What was it like for you, you know, playing in an event of that magnitude? Is it something you can't describe until you walk through that first tee process of like, you know, I'm playing in front of the entire world here and what it's on the line? Like, what are they going to experience?
Honestly, Jay, they are going to experience some nerves like they've never experienced before. I know I did. You know, even the practice rounds, sort of the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday prior, obviously President's Cup starts on a Thursday, Ryder Cup starts on a Friday, so you've got those practice rounds. But the nerves that week were unlike anything else, and obviously you understand you're playing for these 11 other guys and not just yourself, and that sort of amplifies everything. But I do remember that, and I'll tell you a quick story that, lucky enough, I played with Ernie Els in all of the team events, or he was my partner for all four sessions, and we're walking off the first tee on Thursday, our first hole, and Ernie turns around and he looks at me and he says, geez, I haven't cut myself like that for a long time, which in Afrikaans, the English translation is, I haven't shit myself like that for a long time. So, you know, when a guy like Ernie, who's been there, seen it all, he's that nervous. That kind of put me at ease a little bit. But I will say that these guys will experience some nerves like they haven't before.
More than a major championship?
Yeah, 100%. You know, again, I think the fact that you know that you are playing for these other 11 guys, and it's, you know, it amplifies everything. And but, yeah, it's 10 times more than a major championship.
Did that help you having... I guess I know the answer to this, and is it probably the right thing, or was this what the captains would do as well, of having somebody as established as Ernie sort of take you around, at least maybe the first or second round? Is that going to be the normal MO, do you think, of how both captains work with their teams of some guys who haven't been there before and pairing them up with some guys who, you know, if need be, can either give you a hug or a kick in the ass a little bit, depending on how you're kind of going that day? Is that, does that experience from those other players really help those rookies?
Yeah, it does. And I would expect that both of these captains would do that. I mean, I think you'd have to look pretty hard to find pairings where two rookies go out together. I know there obviously have been some cases, but I think for the most part, yeah, the captains will do that. They'll try and send out an experienced guy with one of the rookies too, as you say, maybe put them at a little bit of ease or give them a kick in the ass if they need it.
Any surprises on either team as you've kind of, as a you know, golf fan sort of watching this and then also having the experience as a professional from both sides? Is there any, you know, as fans for us, are any tidbits we should be watching or any interesting matchups or, you know, things we should be looking for this week that you're kind of seeing?
Well, I was surprised with some of the selections, to be honest. You know, everyone's talked about Keegan Bradley. I thought Lucas Glover was the one that was really hard done by on the American team. I'm such a big proponent of form. And obviously Lucas was in as good a form as anybody. To me, he was a massive surprise. And, you know, with Lucas, you know he's always going to drive the ball straight. He's always going to hit it good. Be a great guy to play alternate shot with. To me, that was a big one. And then on the European side, I could not believe that Adrian Meronk didn't get picked.
Yeah.
You know, he won on that golf course the last time they played there. You know, he seemed to be a lock for me. And, I mean, you can tell from all the interviews that he's done that he was shocked that he didn't get picked.
Yeah, and I think some of the guys who did get picked, you know, like for the American team, let's say, you know, Justin Thomas, right? I mean, there's going to be some real pressure on him on this event, right? You can't go 1-3, right? Like, you got to live up to that.
Very much so, yeah. The fact that, you know, Zach Johnson essentially went out on a limb and picked Justin Thomas. Listen, he's got a wonderful record in this event or in the team events in general, but I agree. I think he's going to be coming in with a lot of pressure, and I mean, it's human nature. You're going to want to feel like you need to play well to justify that pick, and it's just that little bit of added pressure.
When you were talking about form, and it was, you know, like when Lucas is just on fire. But Lynn, let's say you have that. Asking this from your career, when you were playing really well, is that something that you can still shut down for 2 or 3 weeks, like that break they would have had? And then was your form still kind of the same if you were on a heater, or did you need to keep playing if you were on that kind of run and playing really well?
You know, if I was playing very good, I would typically maybe even try and add an event to keep on going. You know that it at some point is going to run out, but you know the thing with form is that it breeds so much confidence. So you every time you tee it up, you're expecting to play well, which is a great mindset to have. So Lucas, it would have been obviously about a month gap between the Tour Championship and the Ryder Cup. I don't believe it would have been anything to worry about a loss of form in that time frame.
Yeah, go back, work on a few subtle things, but just keep doing, get out of your own way, right? Keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, no, very much so. And you got to believe that he's full of confidence at the moment. So I feel like he's hard done by. Listen, I feel like Keegan Bradley is as well, but I couldn't understand why nobody was talking about Lucas feeling a little bit unjustified not getting picked there.
I think the European team is going to be better than people thought maybe a year ago. I mean, I think you're starting to see some really, you know, sort of the churning of the guard per se, and some of their young studs, they're pretty darn good.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. You know, I sat down with Johnson Wagner probably about 6 months ago, and we looked at the European Tour on paper and kind of looked at each other and said, how are these guys going to compete? And now it's sort of shaped into what seems to be actually a very, very strong side.
Yeah.
I think the Americans are still favorite on paper, but I would not be at all surprised to see the Europeans pull a little bit of an upset.
You're at least coming down to be very competitive for the singles matches, right? I think it's going to be tight. I really do.
I do too. And, you know, I don't think you can ever underestimate that home field advantage. You know, there's going to be a rowdy crowd there, as it always is. And, you know, that it goes a long, long way. Plus, obviously, you get to set the golf course up how you feel is best for your players. So it should be interesting. I'm looking forward to it.
What's your thoughts on that? You think it should just be set up neutral by, you know, pick the European Tour or the PGA of America and they just both agree to do it? Or do you like the idea that each home team can kind of get their little advantage there? How would you do it in a perfect world?
Honestly, I actually do like it. I like the fact that you're at home, you get to set it up a little bit to your advantage. I don't mind that at all. I think it's one of those things. Plus, obviously, you get to pick whether you want to start out with the foursomes or the four balls. So I don't mind that. I don't mind the little home field advantage there.
Well, the other topic we got to get to, I didn't see this one coming. We talked a little bit of LIV Golf in our first conversation, and, you know, there was some points and counterpoints, and we both agreed, you know, if they offered you a bunch of money and you have a family and you didn't come from a bunch of money, you can understand why the players could take that. It makes sense. I did not see this potential partnership coming together. That's one pro I just about. I thought it was actually a Twitter joke at first, right? Like, is
right.
The Onion doing something, or what's the date? Is April Fool's? It's not. I didn't see this coming.
I think if anybody tells you they saw this coming, they're lying through their teeth, because that was just an absolute shock to everybody.
Yes, on both. I mean, you know, I thought they'd be both so far off that this is not going to happen. Let's assume this happens, and you may know without getting too much information away, but how does this work? What the hell does this look like as a partnership? Do you have any insights?
Honestly, I don't. Through not really asking a lot of questions and not even paying as much attention as I should have to it, I really don't. my feeling is that there is so much stuff that really needs to be ironed out that nobody has any definite answers at the moment. I don't think anybody's really close to having any answers at the moment. I don't know. Listen, it's going to be very, very interesting to see what happens. I wish I knew a little bit more.
I almost like think like to myself, okay, does Liv become a limit, whatever they rename it, right? They may have to rename it just to not piss the whole golf world off. But does that become like the World Golf Championship events where there's 10 or 12 of those out, you know, around the world, and Rolex comes in, or and then you relegate your way up into those events, and you can relegate your way back down to the European Tour or PGA Tour? You know, who's going to be the big dog? I mean, it probably is the guy writing the checks, right? But it's going to have to be something like that of a world tour at some level, right?
Yeah, exactly. Something along those lines. Again, I wish I knew more about it. I wish I had some answers. But again, I think they really don't know. I think the PGA Tour doesn't know. The PIF doesn't know. I think moving forward, things are going to change. It's going to be so fluid for, I see, maybe the next 6 months, even to a year. Now, how long does Liv hang around? There's a lot of questions to be answered.
But I think if it's done right and they can make it come together, I think it could be really cool, right? Like a big event in Sydney would be awesome.
Yeah.
Right? Because you don't see it there that much. Like something in South Africa would be really cool, right? You know, bring it around the world to these great locations, I think would be so good for golf. And if you see the best players, no matter what, even if it's the PGA Tour, it's called the PGA Tour Elite or whatever it is, wouldn't that be cool to see these things in these different regions around? I mean, you're a world player. You played all around the world. Yeah. To see these things all over, I think would be awesome.
You know, and that's the thing, Jay. I think it could be absolutely wonderful. I don't know if you can do that with the powers that are in there right now with Jay Monahan and Greg Norman. It seems like all bridges are burnt between the two of them. Like, is it something that can be resolved while both of them are still around, or do you need to look for new leadership? Or again, it's just a bunch of questions that need to be answered.
Yeah, I agree. I hope they make it work because it's going to be good for golf, and I'm a golf fan.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, they need to kind of check the ego at the door at some point and say, all right, what is going to be the best product for the golf fan, and let's go from there.
Yeah, because if that works, then both sides can say they won, right?
Yep.
You know, the sponsors exactly are right. Happy. The tour players like you guys are happy. No more fighting. Greg could exit stage left, and he did what he did. And I can see where if you check your ego, you could make this work.
Yeah. Yep. I agree 100%. And you could make an absolutely wonderful product, really.
Oh yeah, I'd be keen to watch. You know, I think it'd be great. We'll hope they get there.
Yeah,
it's going to be interesting. Like I said, talk about topic no one saw coming. And, you know, speaking of South Africa, like, you grew up in such an, you know, interesting, beautiful countries in Zimbabwe, and, you know, the sporting lifestyle that's there. And, you know, what was it like growing up there as a young man and all the sports that you played and playing golf? I imagine it had to be a wonderful place to start your sporting career, and also just a great place to grow up when you were a kid.
Yeah, it truly was. It's a sport mad country. Like the sport is everything in that country, from rugby, cricket, golf, football, soccer, as you guys call it over here. That was it. You know, if you played sport, you held some prestige in the country. So I was fortunate enough to play a bunch of sport growing up. It was a requirement for us at school. We had to play two winter sports, two summer sports. So it was one of those things where you were always on the sports field. And, you know, I wouldn't have had it any other way. It was an eye-opener for me over here once I had kids that were old enough to play sport, how everything is run by clubs here. Everything is, you got to pay for club sports. You know, for us, it was school and school pride and sport playing sport and the school pride that carried. So it was, it was a great way to grow up, and I honestly wouldn't have changed it for anything.
Did you grow up on a really good golf course? I mean, was it, you know, something that taught you all the golf shots and made it work? And, I mean, the backdrop had to be a little bit different than what we see in the States from your surroundings, I have to imagine.
Yeah. I was lucky. I grew up on a great golf course. Actually, I was a member at a couple of really nice places. And we got treated so well, the junior golfers there. The Zimbabwe Junior Golf put on a great program where we could play a different golf course during school holidays. We could play a different golf course every day of the week for free.
How cool
and they
is
would,
that?
They would block, yeah, they would block off all the tee times in the morning. So we had the run of the place from sort of 8 o'clock till 1 o'clock, every single day at a different golf course. So it was an absolute treat for us. And, yeah, as I say, wouldn't have changed it for anything.
Who were some of the guys you competed against growing up that kind of made it, you know, professionally in your age bracket that were just tough as nails? You could see the talent, but you loved going head to head with them. I mean, it's such a rich talent of golf in the South African, you know, culture of players. That's kind of, you know, are recognizable names around the world.
Yeah. You know, we were, obviously I was in Zimbabwe and they were in South Africa, but we would play a lot against the South Africans. So Trevor Immelman is the same age I am. Trevor was one that you watched him and you're like, hang on, this guy's really, really good. And you could see he was groomed to be a pro from a young age. Louis and Charles were a couple years younger, but they were coming up, got to play a lot with them. Richard Sterney, who played on the European tour for a long time.
Yeah, he was out there forever.
Played out there for a long time. Brandon Grace as well. Obviously, Brandon's a little bit younger as well. But those were the majority of guys. And you could tell at a young age that all these guys were very, very good.
Yeah, and then, like I said, I meant that region of Africa. You guys were close enough to each other. You knew who the talent was down there. They knew the best in Zimbabwe. I mean, you guys were going to go head-to-head a little bit at some point in time in battle.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. You know, there used to be a World Junior Championships in Japan, and it was only one team from Africa would ever make it. So it would typically be either Zimbabwe or South Africa that would make that the World Championship. So we used to play a lot of test matches against them, and it was always fun going against those guys and seeing where you stacked up.
Also some great, I mean, just legends of the game from you know, that region. You know, Nick Price, Mark McNulty, you know, Tony Johnson, like all the Gary Player, all those guys, Ernie, what did their mentorship mean to you? How it helped you, the doors that opened? I'm assuming it's a tight fraternity, you know, from the guys from that area of the world.
Yeah, very much so. And at the time, Nick Price was world number one. So he would always come back and play the Zimbabwe Open and spend sort of 3 or 4 weeks in Zimbabwe, getting to know some of the younger guys. At that time, I was probably 16, 17, so I was right at the perfect age to go out and play some golf with him and get to know him a little bit. And then we got a little bit closer once I moved over here. I would stay with him down in South Florida every year for the Honda Classic, and we became very, very close. But it was great. You know, he was always very, very generous with his time and spent a bunch of time getting to know some of the younger guys and just explaining the ins and outs of professional golf.
Were you scared as hell at first? Like, oh my God, it's my hero. It's Nick Price. Like,
I can't even tell you. The first time I met him, I was lucky enough to qualify for the Zimbabwe Open. And as I say, he was world number one. So he was back over there playing. And, we both finished our rounds sort of roughly the same time. And, we had mutual friends and somebody introduced me to Nick. That was the first time. And yeah, I was a little bit starstruck at the moment.
Yeah, but, it's Nick Price, man.
It's been great to get to know him pretty well.
Yeah. It's cool when your heroes can become a friend, right? It's a neat thing in life, you know, if that can happen every now and then.
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic. We're going on a golf trip next month to Ohupi for 3 days. So he's taking a couple of us down there. Hopefully he's paying for it all, but, looking forward to that. Should be good. Good time. Have a couple beers and play some golf down there.
What was your journey to professional golf? You know, I know you played at Virginia Tech, so you came over, and then what? You know, there was probably a lot of pathways for you to go. You could have gone Corn Ferry, try to do Europe, go to Sunshine Tour. What was sort of your path that you took, and why did you take that path at that period of time?
Yeah, I was finishing up at Virginia Tech, and I still had, I think, maybe 6 or 9 hours to get my degree. So I stayed at school and then decided to go to Q School while I was finishing up getting my degree that November or October, whenever it was. So I went to Q School here, and I got through the first time and got my full Corn Ferry card. if I hadn't got my full Korn Ferry card right away, I think I probably would have gone to Europe and tried to play in Europe for a little while. That seemed to be sort of the more of the pathway for a lot of the South Africans, Zimbabwean guys, was go spend a few years in Europe and then play your way over here. But lucky enough, I was able to get through to the finals there, which gave me status on Korn Ferry. And then played a couple years out there. I think I spent 3 years on Korn Ferry before I got my card on tour. And honestly, Jay, it was very, very beneficial. You know, you learned how to be a pro. You learned how to travel. You learned how to manage your time properly. Because obviously, when you're in college, you've got somebody that's doing all of that stuff for you. So you got to figure it out pretty quickly.
When you look back, get through Q schools. Hard, as you well know. Like, was that almost good that you had kind of a backup plan where you could kind of, you're young, you're full of confidence, like, I'm just going to freewheel this, and hey, I made it through stage one, all right, let's do stage two. And did it feel like it didn't have the pressure of the world on your shoulders at that time, you know, a little bit?
Oh, I mean, 100%.
Yeah, right? Like, I don't I mean, still pressure, but it wasn't the end of the world if you lost your, if you didn't make it through and try, number, you know, in round one, let's call it, or, you know. Yeah, you had options beyond this.
And honestly, I think when you're coming out of college there's a level of naivety as well, which helped me. I birdied my last hole to make it on the number to get through Q school. And looking at it now, like, that was a big deal. Back then, like, it didn't even feel like it was a big deal. You don't really comprehend the magnitude of what it is, I think. Now, listen, if you don't get through Q school your first time, then probably you start realizing just how important that kind of stuff is. But I remember, as I say, I birdied my last hole, and somebody came up and said, yeah, you made it through. And I thought to myself, okay, that's great. But it didn't feel like it was that big of a deal.
Yeah, then if it was 10 years later, right, it would normally, yeah, right? I mean, yeah, there's something about youth and confidence, right? It's just like, go hit the ball hard, find it, hit it again, get in the damn hole.
Yeah, you know, you're 21, you're so damn cocksure at the time that you're just naive enough, I guess, is probably the best way to put it.
Yeah, and then winning out there on the Korn Ferry Tour, that had to mean a lot, right? That's validation to the work and knowing that your game is really getting ready to be a world-class player.
Yeah, it was. That was, I'd put in my time then. I'd spent a couple years out there. Actually, sorry, I made it to the tour, then I lost my card and went back and spent 1 year on the Korn Ferry Tour and played really well that year. I think that might have been 07. But, yeah, winning out there was a big deal. You know, I hadn't won anything since college, so it had been 3 years without winning. And then to win a professional event and play well on a really good golf course as well was nice.
Looking back, was almost getting your ass kicked that first year on the PGA Tour a good thing, meaning that you kind of knew what you had to work on, and going back to the Korn Ferry Tour made you have that career you had?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. You know, I got out on tour and I felt like I was ready at the time, but looking back, I definitely wasn't. I played better as the year moved along, but it taught me how to my weaknesses were certainly exposed. So yes, that year to go back on Korn Ferry and play there was exactly what I needed.
I always thought your golf swing was I really liked, in the sense that you could eliminate one side of the golf course. And you're starting to see, like, DJ got really world class. I mean, he's a world class talent, but super star status when he kind of stopped hitting a draw and played a fade. And you're seeing a lot of guys with the modern equipment. Shuffler, like, it looks like a very much an anti-left golf swing. I'm guessing at one point in time you played a draw. Every good player does at some point in time. When did it hit you that, look, I'm strong enough, I don't need to hit draws unless I need to, and my stock shot's just going to be the power fade? Like, how did that transpire? Then what did you have to do to your golf swing to kind of be able to, I call it like a professional elimination of one side of the golf course for your stock shot? I know you can hit a draw if you wanted to, but for your comfort zone, just to kind of play that as your normal shot, how did that come about, and when did it hit you that, you know, this is not a bad way to do this?
When I put on about 40 pounds and I had to swing around my gut, was probably when it hit me that I was going to start hitting fades. Through college, I played a draw, as you say. Most good players do. Through college, I played a draw. And then I realized that that one that goes quick left doesn't work when you're playing for a living. So probably that first year on Korn Ferry Tour was when I started really, really making a concerted effort to aim down that left side and hit that fade. I worked with a guy down in Charleston, down at Bulls Bay, Ricky Sullivan, and I went to see him. I'd never really worked with a pro much or with a teacher much, and I went to see him, and I said, listen, Ricky, I want to eliminate the left side of that golf course. And we kind of set out and did that. And, you know, it took obviously a couple of years to get really, really comfortable with it. But, throughout my career on tour, I was always pretty good driver of the golf ball because I had eliminated that left side of the golf course.
And I think the modern equipment helped with that too, right? As you were kind of out there when the balls got less spinny and the drivers got less spinny, yeah. And, you know, you could then hit the hard fade and it damn near went as far as the draw. So what's the point of taking that risk of the left coming in?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, the golf ball started spinning a whole lot less. It was difficult to play that fade, especially in the breeze with that spinny golf ball. Once that ball started spinning a whole lot less, as you say, you're not losing much when you're hitting that fade, and makes it a lot easier. And as you say, nowadays, you don't see many guys that are standing up there and hitting a draw with the driver. It seems like everybody's getting more and more comfortable moving it left to right.
Even us amateurs, right? Like, I played a draw for years, and my driver's set up to hit the little baby fade, you know, ideally, right? For me, it goes as far as the draw without the, oh, my God, I just double-crossed myself, right? It's amazing how that's changed. And you can set the driver up to go low spin and just fall off to the right, and you feel like you're turned through and you release it with your body and not as much hands. It's not a bad way to play golf. It really isn't.
No, it's a great way to play golf. And yeah, you know, that fade, obviously it'll stay in the air a little bit longer. And as you say, if it's not spinning, that's great.
Do you still see shots the way still today? Are you still playing kind of the power fade? Is that still your go-to? That's the way you see it?
It's the way I see it. When it comes out, it feels great. It's not coming out like that as much as I'd like, but that's through a lot of, or little practice, I guess.
If I'm
playing well, I still like to see the ball going left to right.
I have to ask you about this because I thought it was, my opinion, it was great on the U.S. Open pairing. I'm going to call it the Burley Man Group, where they had you with Shane Lowry and Kevin Stadler. Lowry got upset. Stads, I think, laughed it off. Did it bother you at all? Because as a golf fan, I thought it was great. And, like, it's not like you guys aren't athletes. I mean, you guys are all three strong as shit. Like, it's, I mean, you guys hit the crap out of it, right? Like, I thought it was like the lumberjack group. That's what I kind of called it more, right? Like, it's the burly man group, the manly group. Like, call it that.
Right.
Yeah. Like,
I loved it. I thought it was hilarious. I was surprised that Shane got so pissed off. Knowing Shane like I do, I knew him a little bit back then, but he was visibly shaken. Like, he was properly pissed off about that whole thing. Stads was kind of a little bit in between, I think. But honestly, I had no problem with it at all.
I think you just got to own it and just go, you know, hit the hell out of it on the first hole and just go own it, right? Like, it's the Burley Man Group. Let's go low today, boys. Right.
That's right. And I think why Shane got so pissed off was that he had just started getting in the gym. And maybe he'd lost sort of 10, 15 pounds and was starting to feel like he was doing things well. And then all of a sudden he gets thrown in a group with two other fat asses and he's thinking, well, hang on a second, I'm working hard at this. But he was visibly pissed off.
Well, and I would argue too, like, there's been, I mean, I think like Duvall when he lost all of that weight, right? I don't think sometimes right, you're not running a marathon. It's not like you weren't built like a brick shit house, right? Yeah, you had a little belly, but your legs were the size of tree trunks. Your forearms were the size of my legs. Like, there's something to be said about power, right? I mean, there's a reason offensive linemen have bulk. I mean, also think Carl Peterson, right? He played like shit when he lost his belly. Same with Duffner. I mean, it is mass, right? I mean, I'm guessing once you got your groove, you're a professional athlete. You could have dropped 20 pounds if you wanted to, but was there a little bit of that too, of like, this shit works for me. I'm strong as hell. The ball doesn't go left. I'm not messing with this.
Yep. 100%. You know, your body's moving in a certain way at that weight. You lose 20 pounds. All of a sudden, I mean, we all know that the golf swing, an inch here and an inch there, makes a massive, massive difference. So you drop 20, 30 pounds and all of a sudden your arms swing a little bit freer. Hang on a second. Now this ball's going to want to start going left all of a sudden because you don't have your belly in the way to swing around. But yeah, you don't see many guys that lose a bunch of weight that have had some success with it.
And I'm assuming you were still working out to get strong.
Yeah. Yeah. No, very much so. You know, obviously I was carrying some extra weight, but I never felt like I was out of breath come the end of a golf round, or like I was struggling to finish a golf round. I was always surprised when I saw guys trying to drop a bunch of weight, especially when they were playing well.
Yeah. I mean, I think Duffner had to put it back on. The best was Peterson. I mean, I think he'd like talk publicly about it where it's like, I got to put this 30 back on. Like, he played terrible, you know, skinny, you know, so I'm with you on that. Did. Like, if it's working, brother, don't change it. It's hard enough to get out there, right?
Right.
And like you said, you knew you were physically strong. It wasn't like, but you're not running a marathon. You're trying to hit a golf ball in a half a second as friggin' hard as you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
no, having some size and strength doesn't hurt for that part of it.
Yeah.
Going to ask you, like, the media work you're doing now with five clubs and that arena, like, how have you enjoyed taking what all the accomplishments on tour and that life that you had out there and then taking it to the media side, being on the other side of it? Couple more, two or three interesting things about it. How have you enjoyed that? And how is that second career going with that side of things?
Honestly, I've loved it. I've learned so much so quickly because I've had to. When we were golfers and we were playing, we didn't realize that everything that went into putting on a golf broadcast. You know, there's so many moving parts. Almost to the point where I felt a little bit guilty. Like, we were always yelling at cameramen and stuff to get out of the way. But now you realize just how much goes into putting on a successful broadcast. It opens your eyes, definitely. But yes, I certainly have enjoyed it. I'm very thankful to Gary Williams for bringing Johnson Wagner and myself on board. We've done quite a bit of work with him now and the Five Clubs guys. That's been a treat. Gary Williams is very, very good at what he does, and he's made it easy for Johnson and I. It's been a very, very simple transition there. And then been lucky enough to do a bunch of this PGA Tour Live stuff, which is great as well. I wish I had known more about this when I was playing, because, you know, when we're out there on the golf course, you don't realize how many guys are hitting bad shots around you. Now, with this PGA Tour Live stuff, you're watching guys full rounds, and you see just how many bad shots are getting hit out there. So it would have been easier to be a little bit nicer to yourself on the course.
Well, yeah, think about it. You're correct, right? So just imagine me, the golf man. First off, I'm seeing the guys on TV on the weekend who already beat half the best players in the world. So just to make the cut, you're playing pretty good. And then the TV coverage is like out of all of those studs. You're watching like 12 guys who are just like in top form that week.
That's right.
And we think they all play, you guys all play like that. Now, you guys can play like that when you're on. But we think you guys all play like that all the time.
And that's been the feedback that I've received from all my mates that play and like all my friends, that, hang on, we didn't realize how many bad shots get hit during a round of golf. Now, it might add up to 69, 70, but there's still going to be a lot of bad shots in that round of golf. And I think that is good for the amateurs, that they can do that and perhaps, as I say, be a little bit nicer to yourself on the golf course.
Or you probably knew when you had it and you didn't have it, and today a really good round is going to be 70, and then you professionally manage that game that day versus I'm on all eight cylinders, I'm firing at it. That's where you guys become so good, where, you know, some guy's going to shoot 74 in those circumstances, you grind out a 69.
Yeah, no, that's right. You're right. The guys figure out a way to get in the hole a little bit quicker, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I always think an interesting broadcast would be like just show PGA Tour Live stuff of guys on the cut line, right? Like on a Friday afternoon.
That would make for the best TV. It really would. I had this conversation with Johnson Wagner the other day. We were talking about it. If you could somehow get cameras out there, now obviously you'd need a bunch of cameras all over the place, all these guys on the cut line grinding it out. And this has been my biggest argument with these events coming up now. I think, what are they calling it, the Signature Series?
Yeah.
They're talking about all these no-cut events. I hate that. I think it's such a big part of professional golf, and I think it is the best viewing, watching these guys grinding it out on a Friday afternoon. I mean, you're playing for your pride, you know. The best players in the world want to be around for the weekend.
Did you just hate missing cuts? I mean, just did it just irk the shit out of you of missing a cut? Like, would you just grind with everything you had? I mean, I know you're a professional golfer, but I mean, some guys can just let it go and had a bad week. Did it bother the shit out of you if you missed a cut?
Oh man, it was the worst. If you made a stupid bogey on your sort of your 17th or 18th hole in the second round to miss the cut by one, there was no worse feeling than that. It was the worst.
Which is great motivation, right? And that's why I think the coverage would just be so interesting. Even established guys, like when your career was established, I'm sure you still hated it 8 years into your PGA tour career than you did year one, right? Like, what? Like this?
Oh, yeah.
No, wait, what am I doing? I should be making the cut. I'm a top 50 player in the world. Like, what the blank am I doing? Like, then you kick yourself in the ass, and then also too, it's got to be kind of thrilling when you don't have your best stuff and you pull it out of your ass. Knowing that you're just doing it through guts and experience that you just can do this. And you know, and then you kind of find it on Saturday and Sunday and go low.
That's exactly right. The flip side of that was when you birdied your last hole to make the cut. There was no better feeling than that when you birdied 17 or 18 to make it on the number. And then, as you say, I mean, everybody's capable of going out and playing really well on the weekend. And all of a sudden you turn it into a good week.
Right, right. And then all of a sudden you're holding on. All of a sudden you may top 10 it, you know.
Yep.
And then take that momentum going forward. I think it'd be a fascinating thing to watch. And I love watching the pride that professional golfers have of refusing to lose. And I love it that they just friggin' hate missing a cut. Just hate it.
I was doing PGA Tour Live for the Wells Fargo, and we had Rory. And he hit a great tee shot down 18 at Quail Hollow, and it just kicked a little bit left. They've got that stream that runs down the left. And his ball was in the hazard, but stayed up above the water. And just what he needed to make four to make the cut. And watching him grind it out. Like, he took a good 3-4 minutes trying to figure out how he could get this ball somewhere up around the green and make par. And I remember making a comment on the air. Like, if you think it doesn't mean something to these guys to be around for the weekend, just watch this.
Oh,
and you
yeah.
could see that he was grinding with everything he had.
You guys don't get to your level that you're at without having that in your gut or your soul, right? It's just personal pride at that point that I refuse to lose. I refuse to give in. Or if I do go in, I'm still giving it everything I've got. There's no give up on it.
Yeah.
I got a couple other quick hitters here for you. So we got to ask this. I like hearing what the guys have to say. It doesn't have to be a tour course, of course, but the best two or three golf courses you've ever had the honor of playing from an architectural standpoint.
My number one well above everybody else or anything else, excuse me, is Royal Melbourne. I absolutely love Royal Melbourne. I think the bunkering there is phenomenal. The way the golf course changes with just a subtle breeze change. I was fortunate enough to play the Australian Masters and then the World Cup back-to-back weeks, both on Royal Melbourne. So I played the golf course sort of 12, 14 days in a row. And never got once bored at all on that golf course. I thought it was just a architectural masterpiece. That would be number one, way above everything for me.
The angles and everything there too, right? It's such a chess match, and it never plays the same way twice.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you move flags, you know, 5 or 6 feet one way or the other and just completely changes your shots in there. Other ones, I loved Muirfield Village. I thought it was just a great golf course. It was obviously always in pristine condition when we played it, but I just thought it was a great golf course as well. That's up there for me. Was never a huge Pete Dye fan, but I did always like Harbortown. I thought just the way the tee shots were framed through the trees, I liked that. It looked good to my eye. Didn't hurt that I actually had a little bit of success around there. I played pretty well several times, but I always thought that was a good golf course as well.
Muirfield, is it just a solid test of golf? Is it just test every element of your game, and that's what you loved about it, that you had to do everything well on that golf course to do well?
Yes. Yeah, you did. You did. And it's generous off the tee. It's very much a second-shot golf course. But, yes, you did. You had to do everything well out there. And it's one of those golf courses that if you play well, it almost feels like it's a fairly easy test, but then you struggle a little bit and you get a little bit out of position around some of those greens and you're like, hang on a second, this place is hard.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot of pros have told me that's one of their favorite golf courses to play. There's got to be something there from that standpoint.
Yeah.
Best golf shot you ever hit under pressure?
You know, it was probably the best one followed up by one of the worst. I was one shot behind with playing number 18 at the Greenbrier, par 3. And I knew I was one shot behind. I think I was in the last group or maybe the second last group. I knew I needed to make birdie to get into a playoff. And I hit a 7-iron to 4 feet right beneath the hole, just hit the exact shot shape, everything that I wanted, and then pulled the putt and didn't even touch the hole from 4 feet. But it was the shot that I needed to hit, and I pulled it off at the time.
Most talented, just from raw talent, most talented golfer you ever had the pleasure of playing with, where you, even as a pro, you were blown away of how crazy good this player was when they're at their best.
You know, I've got to say Rory, probably. I was lucky enough to play with him for the first time was right when he came out. And I think he was 20 at the time, maybe 21. And we both played well Thursday, Friday. And it was actually at Muirfield Village. And we were in maybe the second or third to last group on Saturday. And David Faraday came up to me and he said, "Prepare to be amazed. You're about to watch a future world number one." I knew who Rory McIlroy was. I'd watched a little bit of European coverage. I'd seen him over there. I didn't know how good he was. But that was a treat. He was, the sound that the golf ball made off the club was a treat, as I say. It was just that much better than the rest of us.
That's crazy. Even at that level, you could still see it where you go, wow.
And I felt that same way the first time I played with Tiger with the irons. Like he hit some iron shots, and it was, you know, the golf course was very difficult. It was at Congressional. The greens were very firm, and he's hitting these beautiful high fades with 3 and 4 irons just straight up in the air and getting these things to land really, really softly where the rest of us are sort of bringing it in. It's chasing it through the back of the green, and it just was a different level.
Did you almost have to stop yourself from watching? Like, look, I'm out here as well to win this thing, and okay, snap yourself back into it, and I can compete with this guy. Okay, it's impressive, but F that. Like, I got a game to play here, and I'm not going to sit here and watch it for 17 holes.
Yeah, you do, and that's not easy to do. It's, you know, being a golfer and being a fan of golf, you know, like, this guy's one of the best of all time. I've always been a fan of Tiger Woods, and you're playing with him, and you're trying to beat him. It's very, very easy to get out of what you're doing. And as you say, you've kind of got to snap back into it and say, hang on a second, I'm still trying to kick this guy's ass.
Right. And I can compete with this guy, and I can do this. Yeah. I think maybe a split second you can go, okay, good shot, and then you got to get back into your own world of what you're doing out there and have to imagine.
Yeah, which is easier said than done at times, no doubt.
Well, thanks, Pro. Like, I really appreciate your time doing this. I think it's going to be a great week of golf, you know, coming up for the Ryder Cup. And, you know, congratulations with everything that you're doing on the media side. And like I said, I enjoyed the first conversation. I'm glad this one's actually getting recorded. And like I said, thanks for doing it. I truly appreciate it.
You're welcome, Jay. Thanks for having me. Anytime.